We are in the thick of Paul's thesis statement. Chapter 3, verse 21. He returns to his thesis statement after the antithesis. He talks about God doing something having to do with the power of God. He talks about justification. He talks about faith. He then gives an example of one who is justified by faith. And now he wants to talk more about his thesis. He's talked about Abraham. Took me a second there. Just kind of lost it. He talked about Abraham, who believed that God was able to give life to the dead. He talks about this concept of Jesus, who received life after death. The two deaths are different. The two lives are different. Jesus didn't have children after he was resurrected, unless you listen to Da Vinci Code or something strange like that, but that's a whole another story. In fact, it is quite a good story, quite fictional, in fact. Makes a great movie, I guess, if you like it, but it is fictional. Why should you study the New Testament, Old Testament? Do people talk about those things in public? Do people write books using themes? How do you know if it's right or not? National Treasure. Anybody like that movie? Yeah. Do they make references to biblical things? Yeah. They're totally false references, but they make references. So if you know the biblical account, you know that they're making a false reference. Therefore, if they're making a false reference, the whole thing's fictional, which is what movies are. Had a fun time. Just caught a little bit of it. Kind of an adventure, poorly done. Trying to remember. The Last Templar was on TV lately. There was this archaeologist who was trying to find some secret decoder, to find the mystery, to find this or that. And it all starts with these Knights Templar during the Crusades leaving Jerusalem by boat. Makes a great story, right? Anybody know where Jerusalem's located? Oh, about 45 miles from the ocean. And they get in this boat and they can see Jerusalem burning on the shore. No, Jerusalem was on the shore. And they could see Jerusalem burning on the shore. What does that tell you about the whole movie? It's false. The whole thing's false because they can't even get the story to make sense. There is no river in Jerusalem that they could get on a boat in and sail out of. It's not possible. And yet people go, man, that's pretty cool. That must have some historical relativity. No, it's absolutely, totally false. So today in Sherman's Lagoon, you know Sherman's Lagoon? We have angelfish visiting this week, and they have to be from heaven. And so it's quoting these scriptural passages in Sherman's Lagoon. Now, if you don't get the intertextual reference, when they quote the Bible in a cartoon, it is not intratextual, it is intertextual. You don't get the humor, right? So why should you know something about the literature called the Old Testament, New Testament, so that you can operate in the world of literature? Kind of a funny thing, but I digress into another topic. So I guess we should move on, Seth. Is that right? Okay. Let's move on. Where was I? Oh, yes. Paul. Using this example named Abraham. About life and death and children and all that sort of stuff. Okay, that's where I digress from. So, what does Paul really want to talk about? See, if we view Romans as Paul's trying to tell the Romans about some sort of problem they have, then we're looking for a problem, and we're still looking for the problem. The only problem that might exist so far is that the Jews and Gentiles don't always see eye to eye. Tell me something new. Male and female don't see eye to eye. You know, people do not see eye to eye unless they're looking at a mirror and then they see eye to eye, sort of. Come on, folks, it's not that bad, right? Wake up. So, we're in chapter 5. He's returning to his thesis. If he's returning to his thesis, what might that tell you about chapter 5? It's pretty important. It's pretty thick. It's pretty heavy. There's a lot in here that Paul is attempting now to flesh out. Because his thesis is easy. I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for salvation. But what does that say? Doesn't say anything. What's the power of God about? Well, he now has described it. The power to give life where there is death. Chapter 3 and 4. We got that. Now, what else is he talking about? Something of salvation and deliverance. So, as we move through Romans, we get to what I think is the heart of his argument. If you want to understand Paul's argument, you have to understand chapter 5. Now, I know chapter 5 is not people's most favorite chapter. They like chapter 8 because it's real positive. It sounds really great. It's got lots of quotable things in it. People don't like the essence. They like the fragrance of the essence, right? When you put perfume on or cologne, I guess girls use perfume and guys cologne. Why are they called two different things? Have you ever figured that out, Daniel? No. Do you like to just stay there and smell the concentrated part? No, why? It's what? You get a headache. It's too overpowering. So you like to have it dissipate and wear off a little bit. And then you catch a light drift. And all of a sudden, oh, that smells nice. Or, that's ugly. But see, the essence is oftentimes too concentrated for us to really enjoy. So we like chapter 8 because it's the wafting of the smell. So, he's going to talk about his thesis here. He's going to expound it almost entirely in chapter 5. He's going to get as much said about the thesis here that he can, but because he's engaged in diatribe, there will be more questions to answer. Things that he has to ask. Yes, ma'am. The perfume is an example of chapter 5 is when you just put it on and it's really strong. People don't like that too much. I mean, it's too much to handle. And people don't pay attention to chapter 5 very much. They like chapter 8. It's the wafting essence of the smell. Right? So, what do we see happening? Well, he's going to talk about the faith of Christ in chapter 19. He's talking about different thing. It's a pretty important chapter as we go through this. So, but it's also continuation because it starts with Jesus was handed over to death for our trespasses, raised for our justification. So, occasionally I've been known to draw a diagram in this class and put two things up here on opposite sides. I do not tend to indicate that they are opposite each other, okay? The opposite of God is sin. Well, there is no opposite of God, right? There just isn't. But there are two parts that Paul is talking about. And in his antithesis, he tends to focus on this side. In his thesis, he focuses on this side. And he describes his antithesis. He says humanity is under sin's power. He views sin as having power. He's going to come back to that. Sin is related to death. God is related to life. So he has this kind of bipolar. It's not really bipolar. He's not schizophrenic and doesn't have a mental illness, but it's a two-sided argument. And so now he's going to focus on the God side. But Jesus was handed over for trespasses. That would be power of sin, justified for our sake. Justification in Paul's mind is a movement from one side to the other. Humanity is under sin's power. Justification or being righteous means you're no longer under sin's power. So that's the movement that's involved. So he starts out there, and then he goes on to say, therefore, because of what I've just said in chapter 4, though Paul's not having chapters, because of what I just said about Abraham being justified by faith, and Abraham believing God could bring life where there was death, and because Jesus was raised from the dead for our justification, because of all that, we have peace with God. Very important. If humanity is, as Paul describes it, over here under sin's power, do they have peace with God? Well, no. Why? Because they're not on God's side of the illustration. How does the peace take place? Justification. Since we are justified by faith, very important theme. Since we are justified by faith, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, the Jew and the Gentiles. In it, the gospel, this proclamation, the righteousness of God is revealed by faith. From faith to faith. Now, he's not saying here anything about whose faith, what faith. He's just saying, how does justification take place? Through faith. He's kind of described that earlier. So now he's just summing up what happens in 4 and 5. One of the fun things about people who want to study Paul's theology is they'll jump to chapter 5. He says we're justified by faith, and then they'll try and read into it what he means by that. They don't go back and look at chapter 4. What kind of faith justifies somebody? A faith like Abraham. Why? Because Abraham is the only person we have in the biblical account who says he was justified by faith. He was credited, he believed God, it was accounted to him as righteousness. What kind of faith does it take? Like we described the last 2 days. Very strong, not weakening, continuing faith. All right? So, we have peace. Now, there's a little discussion about whether it's we have or we will have. There are times in Romans where we don't really know exactly what Paul said. There's a whole study of ancient literature called textual criticism, where you examine all the various texts and try to find out where we're at. Most scholars, I'm not a textual critic, so most textual critical scholars say right now we're about 99.9% sure because of the 5,000 plus manuscripts we have, because of all the evidence we have, because of everything we've been able to acquire, that we know what was actually in the original autograph. Autograph is the one that Paul actually wrote. None of those survive. There is not a storehouse somewhere. It'd be a great movie. Okay, great movie line that somebody goes to the Vatican and steals all the biblical autographs. Great movie. Totally fictional. Why? Because we don't have them. It's not like the Declaration of Independence. Somebody decided we're going to keep this. This is not a society that is keeping a lot of written documents by minority groups. And actually, they're not just minority groups. They are like ultra minority groups, like 0.001% of the entire population. It's not a big deal for them to preserve those writings. So what happens? Copies are made. And copies are made. And then Rome says, we don't like the Christian movement. And they take a political position and burn all of the Christian writings they can find. And they destroy them. They destroy them all? No. Why? Because we have some. And the oldest Christian full copies we have are from after that period of time, from the 4th century, the 300s. We have small pieces here and there before that. But textual criticism deals with that. And so there's a little discussion, be with you in just a minute, about whether it's we have or will have, and there's only one letter that makes a difference. And so, but pretty much we're sure it is will have. Yes, Ms. Howard.
As a, don't you have 2,400
We have over 5,000 various manuscripts. Over 5,000, but they date anywhere from about, I mean, the earliest manuscript we have, and it's about that big, is from 125 A.D. Because they made copies and they didn't keep the autographs and things were burnt and destroyed. And we have a fragment of John that's about that big for 125. The complete copies we have are post the Domitian, no, Diocletian period of 303 A.D. So there's a big argument, discussion in the book. You may have read that. We're not too worried about it. But the question is justification present or future? Well, it's really, in Paul's situation, it's already taken place. So we don't even have to worry about any of that information, okay? It's not really pertinent because most people would not go with the Westcott and Hort. We just mention it. So, but the important part is that there are prepositions in use. Prepositions are important. Does the Greek language have prepositions? Yes, it does have prepositions. Does it always use prepositions? No. And therefore we have the objective-subjective problem. So we are justified by faith. Faith is important. Martin Luther read through Romans, posted 95 theses on the door of the church at Wittenberg, Germany. Said, I want to talk about 95 things. 95 questions I want to talk about. People didn't want to talk about it. And he came up with sola fide, lovely Latin term. Sola fide, solely by faith. Justified solely by faith. Can't do anything else to be justified. Only faith. Started the Protestant Reformation. He probably took seriously Romans chapter 5. Therefore, since we are justified by faith. It doesn't say alone, but that's what he said. He said only by faith. Faith is important for making righteous. That's Paul's thesis. Whose faith, what faith, how faith, it's not quite explained entirely. Our peace is with God. That means we're no longer opposed to God. We have peace. The word peace, let's see, did we hear that before? Oh, the greeting. Grace to you and peace. Shalom. wholeness. Now, peace is the absence of aggression, the absence of violence, the absence of hostility, the absence or the opposite of war. But does the opposite of war actually guarantee peace? No. Well, no. Peace is something entirely different. So when one is justified by faith, something new begins. Peace with God. This kind of concept. And the peace is through Jesus Christ. Paul's pretty specific on that. Why? Well, because of chapter 4. It, righteousness, will be reckoned to us who believe in Him, believe in God, who raised Jesus our Lord from the dead, who was handed over to death for our trespasses, was raised for our justification. There is something about this entire process, Paul says, rests entirely on this person, Jesus, which is really quite remarkable, since he was, you know, the Romans felt he was simply a common criminal, not worth even a decent death, and they crucified him so that he should have hung up there for 3-4 days suffering, but didn't. I mean, just, he was nothing, not worth any kind of recognition. And yet Paul says, wow, there's something going on here. And he goes back to his opening, because grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. That term Lord we talked about a little bit. Who would have been called Lord in Rome? The emperor. And Paul's saying, now there's a different one. There's a term very popular at this point in time, the year 58, not currently. Never found a way to put it on the test yet, but it's a great term. The Pax Romana. After all the controversies and conflict of the first century BC, the civil wars, Octavian, Augustus, Julius Caesar, Gaius, 13 names long, brings about peace. And Rome brings this Pax Romana, the peace of Rome throughout the Mediterranean. And Paul says, where's peace come from? Not the emperor. Comes through this one who died and was raised from death. See, Romans is a very challenging book to the perspective and viewpoint of 58. But the result of faith, Jesus, however that is determined. It doesn't matter if you think of it as objective. It doesn't matter if you think it is a subjective. Everybody agrees the result of pisteos Jesus is peace with God. That's what Paul's proclaiming. Humans can have peace with God. They don't have to be in opposition anymore. That's part of his thesis. So, through whom we have obtained access to this grace, he turns grace, and we boast now in our hope of sharing the glory of God. Could we boast earlier in Romans? Well, no. And most of you in discussion say you can't boast. Why? Because you didn't do anything. You only boast about things that you've done. So what do they have now? What does Paul have now that he can boast about? Peace with God. He has that. He is now part of something. Here's a good question. I don't know anything about most people in here. Anybody on a team that won a state championship? Anybody from a school that won a state championship? Okay, that works. Now, was it only the 5 people on the court at the end of the game or on the field at the end of the game who could boast about winning the state championship? No. Who else boasted about it? The entire school. Did they have anything to do with it? Not directly, but they're part of it. And that's why Paul says we can now boast. We are now part of something. The justification has taken place, and we have peace with God. We are part of something. So what do we boast about? The hope of the glory of God. Uh-huh. Part of the test is going to be matching of some terms and ideas that Paul uses. We have two here, hope and glory. What are they? Well, he has talked about glory, in case you're keeping track. He only uses it four times in the first three chapters. He only uses it once in chapters 4 and 5. So it's not a big term. But it's from doxa. I mean, glory. We get this song called the Doxology, sung in various tunes. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise Him, all creatures here below. It has something to do with the praise of God. But what does he boast about? He boasts something about somehow because of this peace with God, we now have the glory of God. It's kind of important. Right? Anybody ever met somebody famous? Seth, who'd you meet? Martina McBride. Martina McBride. Wow, where'd you meet her?
She's from Medicine Lodge.
She's from Medicine Lodge. I know a guy from Medicine Lodge. Where? What's his name? He's a banker there.
My half sister's dad is a medical.
Yeah. Really? Annie, who'd you meet? Rebecca St. James. Wow.
I've met Kirk Cameron.
Kirk Cameron. That's pretty cool.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But Barry Sanders is doing something.
I met Bill Clinton.
Really?
Yeah, I was about this far from him. He was being interviewed by a TV person. I didn't talk to him. I didn't shake his hand, but I was this close to Bill Clinton, 1992. That's pretty, you know, you're around somebody who's important. That's pretty good, right? Paul says we hope in the glory of God. What is it about this term glory that becomes important? Well, glory has a long, drawn-out history in biblical usage. Sometimes it refers to the honor. So who did I ask if you met? Somebody famous. Famous people have what? More honor than others, right? I could have said anybody met some kind of criminal, and nobody wanted to admit to it, right? Because there's no honor in that. But somebody of high status has honor. Sometimes it's splendor, the brightness, the brilliance. They talk about the glory of God descending into the tabernacle. And there has to be a veil because it's so bright. And that when Moses meets with God, this brightness actually infuses him so much that he kind of glows. Maybe God's radiation or something. I don't know. People glow when they're near radiation or something like that. But it's this brightness that just permeates. But essentially, the essence part of glory is the presence of God. Glory means presence. So you met Martina, you were in her presence. I met Bill Clinton sort of somewhat because I was in the presence, got close, right? So Paul says we boast in the hope of the glory of God, that we now get to participate in the presence. Well, ancient world, how many people got to be around a god? Not very many. If you were a priest in various temples, you got to have some association. Occasionally, there's some stories about a god who visits a city and usually impregnates a woman, and so somebody famous is born and they become part god. But really, the number of people in the population who get to encounter and be in the presence of a God of some sort in the 58, remember, lots of gods, is very, very few. And so Paul says, we get to boast about that. Why? Well, it all has to do with this process called justification. Because of justification, which is through faith, and that's a whole another issue, we can now boast. What? Because we share something. What do we share? This opportunity to be here in presence of God. So when you hear the word glory, there are lots of things you can associate with it, but it usually means the absolute being of God. You want the glory of God to appear. What do you want? You want God to just get a big old spotlight that shines up in the sky and you can see for miles? No. You want God to show up. So it's the being of God. So, what's the other word? Hope. We boast in our hope. Great word, hope. What does it mean? We use it a lot. We even name kids hope. We name boats hope. We name towns hope. What does hope mean? Anybody in here hope to get married? Get them up high if you hope to get married. It's not a bad thing. You know, be proud of it. I hope to get married. Okay. Now, keep them up there. It's stretch time. Get those shoulders stretching. How many of you hope to get married and actually have someone you hope to marry? Keep your hands up. If the person's not in your viewpoint, then you got to take the hand down. Okay? How many of you have that person and you're actually engaged? Oh, there we go. Do you know I don't hope to get married? Been there, done that. All right? Went through that wedding ceremony. It was great fun. Don't want to do that again. Go through a wedding ceremony. Got to decide who's coming and who's not. A friend of mine went out to Las Vegas to plan for the wedding ceremony. I said, just get married when you're out there and save everybody a bunch of time and money. You're going to go out to Las Vegas, get married anyway. Just go out there, get married. Come back here, spend the money on a big celebration here. Right? So how many hope to get married and you're engaged? Was it what, two? Yeah, two of you. See, the rest of you don't hope to get married. You just wish you could get married. Now, we use the term, I hope to get married, but the person hasn't asked you. So you're wishing that they might ask you, so that you might actually get to do something. But hope has two real components. The first is you haven't experienced it yet. That's why I don't hope to get married. I already am married. The second is there is something about the situation that makes you recognize it's actually going to take place. There's been a commitment. Plans are in process. Things are falling in place. You've got the list. You're checking it off. Right? Something has happened to cause a relationship that will end up in marriage. You hope to get married. Otherwise, you're just wishing that this person would ask you, or you would ask them. You're scared to death for whatever purposes. So we hope, right? Hope, as it's defined by Luke Timothy Johnson, is a perception of the present, right? Now, I've got two people. Brian, you're engaged, you said? Okay. So you walk around asking other women out for dates. Don't admit it in this class, right? Has it changed your present reality? Well, yeah, because you have a person who, if you did go out and ask somebody else for a date would probably take a shotgun and or something and punish you in a physical manner, right? Something happens to change our perception of the present, and it's based on God's presence and power. See, a person who's over here under sin's power does not hope in the glory of God. Why? Because it's never going to happen. They're stuck over here. But a person over here recognizes somehow that now that they have peace with God, they have the opportunity to actually travel there. Okay. Hope is that which enables us to move into the future. Hope. Okay? We're moving towards the future with a specific goal in mind. I use marriage as an example because it works pretty well. But it's based on the reality of God's presence in the now time. How many of you girls, because you do most of the work, and I admit that, who are not yet engaged are planning your wedding? Anybody? You're making arrangements. You got the flower person picked out. You got the date scheduled. Now, I've known a few people who did that. They scheduled a date, and then it makes a great TV movie, by the way. Get the date scheduled, and they go out and find somebody who will marry them. You're not making any plans about this wedding because there is nobody to marry yet. There's no commitment. There's no relationship that says we're moving towards this point. The hope that Paul is talking about says there is a reason to make plans. There is a reason to do things differently. There is a reason, and it is God's presence in the now time. So, wow. We are justified by faith. We have peace with God, and that's only 40 minutes. Now, I did wander a little bit, so we'll take that 5 minutes off. 35 minutes to talk about these two verses of Paul's thesis. Is it important? Yes. Is he unpacking it? Yes. He's explaining lots and lots of things. So, the next thing he says, we don't only hope in the glory of God, we hope in our, or we don't only boast in our hope of sharing, we boast in our sufferings. Yeah, all right. How many people go around boasting about their sufferings? I'm just so excited. I get to go home and get beaten up every night. I just love it. It doesn't make any sense, does it? So why would Paul write, we boast in our sufferings? Well, let's see. In the year 58, is suffering a good thing? How many say yes? Get those hands up. How many say no? Some of you aren't participating. Yes, it's good in the ancient world. No, it's not. By now, you ought to know the answer, right? It's great in the ancient world. It's terrible in the modern world, isn't it? We want to alleviate suffering. We don't want anyone to suffer. If we alleviate suffering, what happens?
We feel better,
but we alleviate the process. Anybody ever have leg pains, knee, ankle, your legs hurt growing up? Yeah. What was the result of that suffering? You got taller. You grew. So what if we'd alleviated that suffering? You never had leg pains. You would never grow. So the ancient world recognized suffering is the way in which one grows. How many athletes in here? Your coach make you suffer? Of course. Coaches love to make athletes suffer. Why? It makes you better. Faster, stronger, better as a team. Suffering has its results. Now, there's indiscriminate suffering. He says we boast in our suffering because suffering is something that brings about results. And he uses Jesus' life as an example. frequently. Okay, in chapter 4, the answer is, who does Paul use as an example? That's the question, actually. What's the answer? Abraham. All right, anywhere else in Romans, it's not Abraham. Who does Paul use as an example everywhere else? Jesus. But in chapter 4, the answer is Abraham. And in the ancient world, moral teaching about what is right and wrong comes through suffering. Suffering is part of the educational process. I'm a firm believer of that. That's why people love my classes so much, because I just want to make you suffer. Right? I want to make you work. I want to push you. I want you to learn through having to do things you are not comfortable doing, which is basically suffering. It makes us a little bit uncomfortable. Or a lot uncomfortable. I remember some of those workouts. Okay? To the ancient world, suffering is part of the learning process. So we boast in our suffering. Why? Well, because suffering, and this is just, he's building to a point, suffering produces something. What does suffering produce? He says it produces endurance. Long-distance runners. Any long-distance runners? Okay. What do you have to run long distance? Endurance. You know? I might be able to run 5 yards. 5 miles? No endurance. I was a wrestler. We had to wrestle for 6 minutes. You had to go out there for 6 minutes and give everything the whole time. So we practiced doing it for 3, right? No, we'd go 9, 12 minutes at a time in practice till we just could barely even stand up. Why? So we could go 6. So long-distance runners, you never run farther than you have to run in a race. You run a 5K, and so all you ever do is run a 5K. You never go a bit farther than that. No, suffering produces endurance. Endurance then produces character. Someone who has endured something has character. We say that all the time. I can't believe the character that person has. Why? Because life was easy for them? No, because they went through some very hard times. And those hard times produce character and something that you can see. And the character that is produced then produces hope. Hope. So in chapter 5, Paul's talking a lot about hope. We boast in the hope of the glory. He then goes back and he talks about suffering. We boast in our suffering. Why? Because suffering, in the end result, produces hope. Why, girls, why do you date guys? You know? Because you like suffering. I understand that. I can say that. You like suffering. Suffering produces endurance, so you keep doing it over and over again. Endurance produces character. And eventually, the right guy comes and says, "Will you marry me?" And now you say, "Well, no, I'm not going to marry you. I like suffering." No, you say, "Well, certainly. What took you so long to answer the ask the question? I've been ready for 6 months." Well, he was scared to death, okay? So, but what do you have now? Hope. You hope you'll get married because you have this. Now, this, the most tragic story is about car wrecks. And they say this person was engaged to be married. Because all that hope is what? Shattered. The hope that those two people had, and one survives, what happens? It's shattered. But suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and that hope does not disappoint because it is hope in God. The hope does not disappoint. God's love has been poured out into our hearts. So we boast about all of these things. Paul says, because we're part of this, we can get excited about it. Most people don't get excited about chapter 5. They get excited about chapter 8. Chapter 8 is just the afterglow. Did we have Valentine's Day recently? Mm-hmm. Did you get some perfume from anybody? Mm-hmm. No. I'm sorry. That's okay. Not bad. Anybody get any perfume for Valentine's Day? No? Well, so much for that example. Can't use that. All right. So, all right, here we go. God's love has been poured into our hearts. So what we've talked about so far? Faith, hope, love. Some of you are familiar with 1 Corinthians 13, shows up on a lot of wedding things. The greatest of these is love. Here Paul brings three of the most important attributes all together in the same essential sentence. Because even though there may be more than one, it's probably one sentence in Paul's Greek. Have to double check that with Josh there, who's got the text. But these three things are all brought together. Do you think that's important when he brings all three together? Yes. So we have one word we have to put on the card called faith. Ought to know that. Hope. Glory. What's the next one you're going to put on a card? Love. It's actually called agape. We'll talk all about that on Friday, because don't want to run out. But why is five important? Because Paul brings so many things together here as he goes, this is what I like to talk about. God's faith, God's hope, and God's love that we need now get to be part of. We get to experience it. Anybody win the lottery? Would you celebrate? Well, yeah. Why? Because you get to be part of it. Would your family celebrate? Well, yes. As long as they weren't mean to you. And because why? They get to be part of it. And that's what makes it exciting. So we'll pick up there on Friday. Make sure you're doing your assignments ahead of time so you don't have to do it all over the weekend.